Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, November 20th. Thinking about moving away, it's an issue that surfaced recently about the out-migration here in the islands due to economic worries. We take a look at the results of a new survey. We explore the idea behind natural farming in the Korean culture. We escape to a Big Island refuge, rallying around our feathered friends and their future. A national refuge marks four decades of conservation success. We were there on the one day of the year they welcome visitors. Plus, a poet's influence on a poet. We hear from a New York writer about inspiration from a garden, trading the skyscrapers for time among the palm trees and the chickens. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Immigration has been dominating the headlines across the country, but today we consider out-migration. There's a new report out looking at affordability issues affecting our residents. HPR's Ashley Mizuo joins us in the studio this morning to talk about this. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, it is crazy when you think of how many people have left Hawaii because it's becoming so expensive.
Right, yeah. And I think that's what Holomua Collective, which is a nonprofit focused on affordability issues in Hawaii, wanted to find out about who wants to leave and why. And that's why they did this survey that showed that almost half of middle-income workers are unsure if they'll have to leave the state to go to somewhere less expensive. It asked over 3,000 local workers about cost of living issues and focuses on middle-income households, most of which make above $100,000 a year, and the average household was three. So usually like two working parents and then a child. Here's Holomua Collective Executive Director Josh Wish.
One thing that's really interesting about the survey is the overwhelming majority of the survey are people that a lot of folks might normally think are doing just fine. 61% of our survey respondents in a median household size of three make $100,000 a year or more. And so I think if you mentioned that kind of a salary to a lot of people, they'd think, well, those folks are probably fine. But you find out actually that this cost of living crisis, this affordability crisis we have, is really extending to everybody. And one of the things we asked folks is, do you think you're going to need to move to a less expensive state? And 75% of the people we asked said either yes or maybe to that question.
That's high.
That's really high. Yeah. And, you know, this is the second time the Holomua Collective has done the survey, although this year the number of respondents has nearly doubled compared. And then compared to last year, the percentage of those who said they would be leaving the state for somewhere less expensive within the next 5 years went from 44% to 57%, which says is significant.
That part is always especially jarring to me because I think if you just ask people, do you think you're going to need to move? And they say, well, maybe that's one thing. But if they say they're going to need to move within 5 years, then I think that's gone beyond just maybe, and it shows a certain amount of planning.
And so, you know, the majority of the people that were surveyed were lifetime residents in Hawaii, which is 63% of the people who responded to the survey. 19% were here for over 20 years. So, you know, long-term residents who've been here for a very long time. Another interesting change from the 2024 survey to 2025 is the salary at which the financial pressure to leave starts to ease. Last year, that was around $100,000 is when people started to feel a little bit less financial pressure to leave. This year, it's $150,000. And when they were asked about what could change to keep them living in Hawaii, the top three answers were for wages to match the cost of living, economic stability, and housing affordability, which is kind of no surprise there. But you know, 91% of respondents say that the state needs to do more to recruit and retain workforces like educators, healthcare workers. 90% said to build housing dedicated for local residents, and 81% said increased access to childcare and education for children between 0 and 5. One of the main issues, though, is a trust in institutions. Respondents were also asked if they had confidence in institutions like government, labor unions, public schools, businesses, or nonprofits to do right by Hawaii working families. Nonprofits had the highest percentage of confidence at 54%, and government had the lowest at 20%. Here's Wish.
I think there are a couple of things we're seeing. One is you can kind of sense right now, nationally, certainly, and locally to a certain extent, that there is just a bit of a trust gap between public and institutions. And there's also, I think, a certain gap between what a lot of groups are trying to do to help the community and what people are aware is actually happening. One other question that we also asked was whether people are aware of workforce development programs that exist. And a lot of the people, and especially a lot of the people who benefit from them, aren't aware of those programs, even though they're out there. So I think we see both a need to get people together to actually increase trust, increase faith in institutions, and a big communications gap of what those institutions are trying to do for the community and what people are actually seeing and feeling.
So some of it's like messaging, I guess.
Yeah. It's a combination of both, right? So it's the confidence in these institutions to do the right thing, to be doing, making policies, making changes to help working people in Hawaii. The confidence in that is low. I mean, 54% for nonprofits was the highest, and that's barely 50% confidence. But then there's also that other hand of just lack of communication or people just not understanding like what resources are available to them, or that policies that take a long time and are not aware of that the policy exists. You know, almost half of the respondents said that they were unaware of workforce development programs in the state, although there are some. And Wish added that that issue is also similar to housing. You know, people don't understand or know about what's been passed or what's going on there. You know, for example, the state has the Rental Housing Revolving Fund, which is actually the number one discretionary expenditure fund that the legislature is investing in besides like the rainy day fund. It subsidizes affordable housing by giving favorable loans to affordable housing projects. You know, the interest rates for these are below like 1%, and repayment periods don't start for like 30 years. And then the state has put in over $1 billion into this revolving fund for affordable housing over the last decade, and putting another $200 million in over the next 2 years. But it really does take a long time for buildings to be built, so people don't necessarily feel or see the impact of that for years and years. You know, there's a law that they tried to pass this past session that would put some of that revolving fund for affordable housing into a sub-account to go to people who are focused in that 100 to 140% AMI. They call them like the gap group, that they don't necessarily qualify for any federal programs, but they're still not making enough to actually afford to live in Hawaii. And the idea for that sub-account was to make housing quicker by moving the money through that revolving fund faster, because you know, if you're not building for the lowest income, it's easier to get things built, and so it's quicker. However, it's a bill that, you know, Holomua Collective did support, but it was passed. Even though it was passed, there were no funds that were actually put into the account, so it's basically not able to be used until something like that happens. But of course, the flip side is that many people, you know, think that the state shouldn't be subsidizing housing for those who make higher incomes, when people with lower incomes still have significant need. But that's why, so Wish hopes that the results of the survey will help drive these policy type of decisions going forward, including Holomua Collaborative's legislative package next year.
We had so many people writing in with, here's what would help, here's how I make ends meet, here's what needs to change. One of the things that tells us is that people are facing really challenging times, but they're also working really hard to find a ray of hope and to find some sunshine and to find a way to stay here. And a key part is we need to listen to them. And that's what we're trying to do.
You know, last year, Holomua Collaborative was pushing a bill that would have paid homeowners to put a deed restriction on their home so it can only be occupied by people who work in the county. That didn't pass, but it was an effort to reserve housing for local residents versus outside investors. There's kind of no way for the state to actually like necessarily ban outside investors from buying property in Hawaii. But this was kind of a method, and they're going to be trying to push that bill again, probably next session.
Yeah, I remember when that went through, and it was interesting conversations that were being had about, yeah, this is a way to say we're going to commit to keep prices lower to keep our people here.
Right. Reserving housing for local residents.
Yeah, interesting issue. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been hearing from HFAIR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. She had the results of a new survey out by the nonprofit Holomua Collective that focuses on affordability issues.
Support for HPR comes from Highway Inn Hawaiian Food, located in Kaka'ako, Waipahu, and now at Bishop Museum, its reimagined cafe, Tutu's Place. Group reservations at myhighwayinn.com.
Album of the Year winning Hawaii artists Kala'e and Kalana Parrish are bringing their island country style music to our Live from the Atherton Celebrate 808 concert series. Join us on Saturday, November 22nd for an evening of music inspired by Hawaii's beautiful countryside. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
We often hear about good bacteria in our gut, but the same could be said of the gut of our soil. This morning, we turn our attention to the principles behind farming in Korea. Joining us to talk about this is Editor Noelle Fujii Oride from Overstory Hawaii. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
We hear that this is sometimes called natural farming or regenerative farming, but gosh, it just seems like going back to basics, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely that. And Korean natural farming, or more often called natural farming in Hawaii, is a type of regenerative ag that focuses on two key principles. One of them is cultivating indigenous microorganisms, so the beneficial bacteria and fungi in a soil to build your soil's health and fertility. And then two, using nutrient-rich mixtures made from natural materials that are found on your farm or garden or maybe from your local area. And so with this approach, you're really working in harmony with nature, not trying to force it along, like forcing it to grow big or forcing it to grow fast.
Some people think, oh yeah, we rely too much on chemicals, right? Fertilizers and pesticides.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually one of the big draws of this method, is that it means they don't have to use as much or sometimes any synthetic fertilizers or pesticides on their farm. There's a farm in Waianae that has actually been able to completely eliminate its use of synthetic chemicals because of this method. And this approach can also be used with other types of farming, like organic and permaculture.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. The article talks about spraying like plant juice from, you know, one fruit to another plant.
Yeah. Folks have used things like banana flour, ulu, or sometimes if they're targeting a specific crop, they'll actually use that crop and ferment it for about a week with brown sugar and then spray it on that plant. And so that's supposed to help it grow better and give it the food that it needs to thrive. Also, like, I mean, there is this one Windward Oahu farmer, for example, and his land was just covered in weeds, had no topsoil, and was really depleted from chemicals like Roundup and Miracle-Gro. In addition to using those nutrient-rich mixtures, he also fed his land with things like biochar, compost, mulch, dust from his pig pens. He also had mineral dust from his Papa Ku'i'ai and Pohaku Ku'i'ai workshops. And today, his land is very productive because of those things, right? He has a six-year-old avocado tree that he often points to as his shining example. And it's already something like 25 feet tall, and he estimates it must have something like 1,000 pounds of fruit on it. So it's much, much bigger than it would normally be at that age.
I know sometimes I use like the seaweed from my pond, you know, in my garden just to help boost it.
Yeah, so I guess these natural materials are supposed to have different minerals or nutrients plants need. Like there's a spray in natural farming that uses diluted seawater, right, to deliver a specific mineral to plants.
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing stories about when we had the fish kill here in Honolulu Harbor. A lot of those dead fish were taken to a place on the west side and they created a fertilizer with the fish meal.
Yeah, very much in line with natural farming. There's a recipe under natural farming that calls for fermenting fish guts for about 6 months. And I will say, though, that this isn't like a foolproof farming method. There's a retired extension agent I spoke with, and he actually helped bring natural farming, Korean natural farming, to Hawaii. And he often says that it takes farmers maybe 3 years to fully adopt this method, just because there is such a big learning curve. Farmers are really learning by trial and error, and they also have to really train their eyes to notice the small changes in their crops and then how to respond to them.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, I'm just thinking of on Kauai doing a story with someone who was using a chicken tractor, and he had basically a chicken coop on wheels. You know, the chicken poop was used to fertilize his cashew trees, and it's just using natural, basic organic things.
Yeah, kind of just taking the science behind these natural materials and just really bringing out the strengths of them.
Well, it's great that you can highlight this and that more farmers are finding out about it.
Yeah, I think there's about 2,000 folks are estimated to be practicing natural farming across the island. So that was pretty neat to hear.
Well, hopefully more people consider this. But thank you so much, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
That was editor Noelle Fujii-Oride. You can find the full story online at overstoryhawaii.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We are digging into the music archives in search of a musician who became a nationwide star. His main instrument was the lap steel, but he was a guitar and ukulele virtuoso as well. Audience members were wowed by one of his signature stunts, which was playing a version of Turkey in the Straw with his feet. He started his career performing in a band led by his brother Joe, called the Hawaiian Novelty Five. They had a regular gig on the Matsonia passenger line that sailed between Honolulu and San Francisco and went on to have a slot on the Orpheum Vaudeville Circuit's North America Tour. Our mystery musician was able to build on his vaudeville exposure to launch a solo career that established him as one of the island's premier instrumentalists. This morning, we're looking for his name and the regal moniker that went with it. Think you know? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreith Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, nāreithhawaii.com.
HPR is hiring a communications and digital marketing manager to oversee the effort to promote our station's statewide services on the air and across digital platforms. If you have marketing experience and consider yourself to be especially skilled on digital media, apply now to be a part of the team. For more information, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The Galliard String Quartet and the Spring Wind Quintet perform music of Mozart and more this Saturday at Orvis Auditorium. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
brush fire on the slopes of Mauna Kea burned more than 2,000 acres before it was contained last week. It narrowly missed the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, a critical habitat for endangered native birds. The refuge just can't seem to catch a break, from cuts by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to impacts of the government shutdown. The Conversation's Maddie Bender recently visited the refuge on the one day a year that it was open to the public, and she takes us there.
All right. Thank you so much for coming out to join us and our friends group as we celebrate our 40th anniversary as a refuge.
Leah Messer addresses a crowd in an open field at the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge. Just hours before, the only occupants of the field were a group of nene. Now, volunteers direct four-wheel drive vehicles to overflow parking, and 500 pairs of hiking boots flatten the grass, still slick with the morning's dew. Today is the only day all year that the refuge is open to the public. The nonprofit Friends of the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge runs the event as a way to bring new faces to the refuge and re-engage old friends. Much like in past years, the Find Your Wild event is at capacity. But this year is extra special. It marks the 40th anniversary that the Hakalau Forest has been managed as a national wildlife refuge by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The milestone has put everyone in a reflective mood, including Springer Kay, who's the interim manager of the refuge.
Well, you know, the annual event here is always feels like a family reunion. You know, I was an intern here in 1999. So some of the folks that are volunteering or on the board of the Friends of Hakalau were my mentors back then when I was in my 20s. And so it's really special to just walk through, walk down the road, see everyone enjoying the forest so much, and really notice the changes. When I was an intern, you had to hike hours down into the forest, into the deepest parts of the forest, to see an Akiapola owl or an olivee, our endangered forest birds. And today, as I left the parking area to just start down the walk, I was able to show a whole group of visitors an olivee foraging just 10 feet off the side of the road in koa that are probably only 4 inches in diameter. So trees that were planted less than 10 years ago are providing habitat for our endangered forest birds, and that's just really exciting.
The forest has a remarkable history, and the people gathering at Find Your Wild are celebrating what they've accomplished over the past decades. Bill Stormont is a Friends of Hakalau board member. He puts the dramatic difference into perspective.
I remember when this looked like that.
This is radio. You need to describe.
No. Well, the history, right, was, and I'm sure others have shared it with you too, but 50 years ago, there was an effort put forward to do surveys across the state for forest birds. Landmark work, remarkable stuff, and the transects that they laid out, and especially on this island, and just, I mean, crazy places. And spending weeks and weeks on trails, on transects, doing bird counts. And this place was identified as a very important habitat for certain critically endangered forest birds on Hawaii Island. Even without this level of kind of recreated koa forest, there was enough remnant koa and other habitat around for them to still be here. And so that began the effort to designate Hakalau, and that came 10 years later. Staff followed, and then the work began of doing the habitat protection work and the tremendous volunteer work that has happened over the last 35 years of over 700,000 trees planted here, 90% by volunteers. And so, yes, we're standing beneath koa trees and across the road where it hasn't been planted yet is what it used to look like. It's just basically open pasture with a few scattered trees. But here it's almost a closed canopy koa forest with understory components coming in, like the native mints here and the olapa we took a sniff of earlier and the kava'u and the native blackberry. So that's all, those components of the ecosystems are now beginning to fill in. And that all adds to the habitat for the birds, because the birds rely on the fruits. The blackberry from the olapa is a favored food. It's also kapa dye, used for dye. So all that's coming now. So that's the short version of the story of Hakalau.
It's been about a year since I'd last been to the refuge. I spent a weekend there covering a volunteer-run program called Beginner Bird School. It was supposed to be a heartwarming story about people coming together to appreciate native birds. Then, as I was putting the story together, I heard that the volunteer leader of the program had been fired from his full-time job at the refuge. Half the field staff had been dismissed at an impersonal meeting. Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency directed the Fish and Wildlife Service to make the cuts. Eric Preston Hamron was the Hakalau employee who led Beginner Bird School in a volunteer capacity. He wound up being reinstated after about a month, but the experience rattled the sense of security that many seem to have about Hakalau. The Find Your Wild event being held today is about marking 40 years of the refuge and acknowledging hard-earned successes. But I have other concerns on my mind. What does it take to sustain the gains we've made in conservation? And what happens if that work stops? I pose that question to Bill Stormont.
It seems like you and the other folks I've talked to aren't as concerned by the threat of, like, funding lost, staff firings. 40 years means, I guess, you can take the long view and say there have been ups and downs.
Well, you need to. In ecosystem restoration here in the islands, it's a long-term goal. But that takes energy. It takes funding. It takes people. Because you build a fence, you don't walk away. You have to check that fence on a monthly basis. You have to make sure that there aren't any opportunities for the animals that you got out of there to get back in. When you do that, you have to be able to commit long-term, in perpetuity essentially, to maintaining that. Otherwise, all that effort, all that money that's been put into the beginning of the restoration work is gone.
Staff and volunteers are planning for the future of the refuge, even as they react to a changing political climate that's directly affected their work. The refuge recently opened a new greenhouse, thanks in part to the Friends of Hakalau. The nursery houses around 8,000 native plants in total. I run into a couple familiar faces among neat rows of mamane, ohia, and koa seedlings.
Oh, hi, Maddie.
Hi, Eric.
That's Eric Preston Hamron, who was terminated by DOGE and reinstated. He's back in his role as nursery manager at the refuge and is surprisingly optimistic about the future of the forest.
So I've been here for a year and a half, and native plants grow slow. Native plants grow slow in cold environments, like up here. So it's taken us a year and a half, and we're just getting our first plants ready to go out the door, back planted into the forest. So we've collected the seeds, we've cleaned the seeds, we've sprouted them, potted them, cared for them, and then now our first babies grown in this greenhouse since I've been here, restarting the restoration program and the nursery, getting that back up. And our goal is to get up to 30,000 plants a year.
A spokesperson for the Fish and Wildlife Service said in a statement that the agency does not comment on personnel matters. But Zoe Naumoff is wrapping up a year at the Hakalau Nursery through the nonprofit Kupu. She reflects on the tumult she's seen.
I'm definitely in my feels. Yeah, it's like my last time up here, I think, for a long time. The next time I come up here, it'll be a totally different forest, I hope. So definitely putting me in my feels. It's like saying bye to all my babies.
Over the past year, you've seen your fair share of ups and downs. What's your mood? What's your outlook?
I'm, despite everything going on and all, you know, like, everyone has to be careful about what they say. But I'm really hopeful about this project particularly, just because I know Eric is so committed. Like, even if he does get laid off, he will volunteer his time to come and take care of these plants. He's not going to leave them up here to just be abandoned and die. Like, and he proved that when he got terminated and he kept coming up before he was reinstated again. So I'm confident that the people here are really committed. I'm confident that the community is really committed. Like, we have so many people showing up, so many people donating. That gives me a lot of hope. Like, the people around the project give me a lot of hope.
We've been hearing from the helping hands at the Hakalau National Wildlife Refuge. HBR's Maddie Bender first discovered the wonders there attending Beginning Bird School last fall. We'll have more after a break. A let's get back out in the forest at Hakalau, where we hear more about the challenges facing not just the birds, but the humans helping our native species thrive. Here's HBR's Maddie Bender picking the story back up.
Bailey Daniels is president of the Hawaii chapter of the Wildlife Society. She has a similar perspective on the resilience that the employees at the refuge have shown since the Doge cuts.
It's not about money. I mean, if it was about money, I'd be in a completely different career than I'm in. But conservation's more than that. It's about taking care of the land. It's about taking care of everyone that lives there and community. And Hakalau really shows that. And everyone who went through that showed that it's what it's really about, not the money, not the job. It's more than that. It's the love and the passion that they have for this land. And I'm really lucky that I had the opportunity to come up here and be a part of it.
Daniels has a point, but it is a little bit about the money. The Friends of Hakalau are building up a nest egg in the form of a $3.5 million endowment fund. So far, they've raised over $2 million. Board member Ken Kupchak tells me about the plan to ensure a future for the refuge.
We started about 6-7 years ago. And that's the people come, they see it, and they want to contribute. We've got a place for them. And that's designed to help maintain this place if there are gaps in federal budgets and things of that nature. And we picked our target as a number of what it would take to maintain it for a year on it if there was no funding. Well, that would use it all up, so we don't want to do that, but we're working towards that.
So with that endowment fund, did you think, you know, back in March that you would have to tap into that?
Well, what the Friends of Hakalau did is they didn't tap into it because we're trying to reach our maintenance goal. We raised money on the side, and they raised $200,000 in a month. So, and that's sitting there because they haven't had to use it yet. So, yes, many of the refuges and the Friends groups are trying to see what they need to do to bridge the gap if a gap occurs.
In the months after the Doge cuts and reinstatements, 6 of the 17 staff members at the refuge have left. Most of the positions haven't been filled.
The team leader, this deputy team leader, they had a maintenance, and a staff member that was doing all the paperwork. Yeah, we had lunch with them about a week ago.
I mean, it seems, maybe to me, it seems like a no-brainer that there should be a maintenance team, right?
Yes.
I asked Kupchak if he feels like the current uncertainty over staffing and budget is a momentary setback or if it's an existential threat to the refuge. Keep in mind, we spoke before the federal government was shut down for over a month.
I think it's going to be a problem with budgets for everything in the country for the next 3 years.
So what do you want people to do about it?
We're building our endowment to be able to step in if we need to. That's what's happening here. The other refuges aren't as lucky to have a group of people that have raised that kind of money.
A whole lot of money and constant work go into maintaining the perimeter fence around Hakalau. It might not sound flashy, but Kupchak says the fence is key to preserving both the forest and the native species that call it home. If invasive species get in, it's back to square one.
Pigs and goats and the sheep get in, and they multiply so rapidly that all the work we've done to bring them down, we've lost. We have to start over. So I've been making this point in the national basis when they're doing the budgets. We have about 20 refuges that have endangered species, and we can't defer our maintenance beyond 90 days.
We know by now what happened. Between October 1st and November 12th, the federal government was shut down for the longest stretch in U.S. history. All but 2 of the Fish and Wildlife employees at Hakalau were furloughed. I spoke with Pete Stein during the shutdown about its effects. He's a retired Fish and Wildlife Service employee and the current Friends of Hakalau board president.
Since the shutdown, the refuge staff is by and large not working. I mean, I think they have some emergency contingencies that makes some of the staff available for emergencies, but for the most part, they're just not there. You know, we're concerned, of course, because for one thing, they have those 2 greenhouses with all the seedlings in them that needs to be taken care of. You know, it's a big investment. And those seedlings are critical to the outplanting program. And then the pig management, you know, that never goes away. All of the threats that the refuge faces just don't go away. We've made so much progress in adding healthy, productive forest over the many years. All of that has come to somewhat of a halt. You know, who knows what the longer term implications will be, but it's definitely not good for a place that needs care and feeding constantly.
The Friends of Hakalau didn't tap into the endowment they've been building, not during staff departures or a government shutdown. Hakalau may be the forest the community built, but its survival over the next 40 years may depend on more than the community alone. Stein says the Friends of Hakalau don't see their efforts as a replacement for federal support.
We're there to supplement. We're there to help. But we cannot, and in my opinion, should not be a substitute for the responsibility that the federal government has to operate the refuge. There are laws that direct them to do so. And, you know, so we're not trying to come into the situation and replace that. We're there to supplement and help them.
We've been hearing from staff and community members at the Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge. The Friends of Hakalau will be holding a 40th anniversary gala and fundraiser on Friday, November 21st at the Kona Salt Farm. Head to our website later today for more information. And a note, Ken and Patty Kupchik, in support of the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, are underwriters of HPR. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a bright yellow rare honeycreeper found in high elevations of the Big Island.
Akia pola au are large, bright yellow honeycreepers that act like woodpeckers. They use their strong lower bill to peck holes in the branches of trees. Then they use their long, curved upper bill to pry out the tasty insect larvae. There are less than 2,000 of these birds left, mainly because of habitat loss and mosquito-transmitted avian malaria. And nowadays, their song can only be heard in high-elevation koa forests on the Big Island, where it's too cold for mosquitoes. In addition to controlling mosquitoes, planting koa forests would be a great way to increase populations of this very rare and important species. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, James Campbell, Ko'olau Mountains, and Pearl Harbor. More at friendsofoahunwr.org.
And now it's time to give you the answer to the backyard quiz. We were looking for the name of a local musician who became a national star riding on the popularity of the Hawaiian music craze of the 1920s. Back in those days, the public would be fixated on songs like Hula Blues and the Aloha Waltz. His name can be found on collectible records on vintage 78s released under a variety of labels, including Columbia, Victor, and Grey Gull, and under multiple names, including the Hawaiian Beachcombers and the Four Hawaiian Guitars. As the story goes, one night in 1935, while driving home from a performance, our mystery virtuoso was suddenly struck blind. No medical cause was ever identified. But his blindness didn't stop him from performing for more than two decades or from completing a record-setting 22-mile swim from San Pedro, California to Santa Catalina Island in just over 22 hours. In his heyday, King Benny Nawahi, alongside childhood friend Sol Ho'opi'i, were known as the stars of the Hawaiian steel guitar. That was our answer for today's backyard quiz, and we had no winners. Rachel Eliza Griffiths is a writer and visual artist from the Big Apple. She will present her work tonight at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Griffiths is currently the writer-in-residence at the Merwin Conservancy on Maui. She talked with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about her affection for the work of the late poet W.S. Merwin and how spending time in his gardens is affecting her own creativity.
For me, it feels like my engagement with his work has expanded exponentially by seeing the actual world that he placed himself in. It feels like he really approached poetry as his calling and tending the earth in a way. I'm a big nature person, so being here to see the trees and think of the trees, I think tree is a word that appears so often in his poetry, but I think to look around at trees he loved over thousands of trees he planted in a space that was once a kind of barren, fallow, worked over piece of land. And now there's no trace of those memories. But what is here is this kind of resplendent jungle. And so being in his meditation room, seeing the kind of intentional way he organized his life, it breathes a different kind of energy into the work, the feeling of the world being bigger than you, or you just being in the right balance with the earth, your place or what your purpose is, feels very special to me. And when I was a baby poet a long time ago now, I remember the last time I saw W.S. Merwin at a reading at the 92nd Street Y, and I will always remember his voice filling up this auditorium. And you felt like you were in another time. And that's what it feels like coming here with these 30, 40 foot trees, the palm trees. It's been raining here since I arrived, actually. So much for amazing sunshine, but I know it's there above the rain, which means there's also rainbows somewhere on this island. But to hear his voice fill the auditorium when I was younger, it just gave me hope and it helped me feel grounded and rooted in a way that you really need when you're a younger poet trying to figure out how are you going to have a life? How are you going to live? And what I see here and what I get to witness is a very intentional, extraordinary, natural, rooted, grounded, but also deeply spiritual life and existence here. And I find that very moving. And so as I've been here for the past few days, I find myself crying all the time. I look at a teapot of his, I start crying, and I look at his desk, I look at his pens and pencils and the objects that were part of his daily, ordinary life. And yet, whenever I read his work and spend time with it, I feel as if I'm transported into this almost altered, special place that we all have, a kind of sacred space, just that we're human beings. It feels really significant to me. So I remember when I was younger, going up in the signing line at the 92nd Street Y, and I was such a nerd. I had like two shopping bags of W.S. Merwin books and asked him if he'd sign them. I'm sure the people in the line behind me weren't pleased with me, but just seeing him, I just started to cry. And I remember him looking up and his eyes were just so human and beautiful and kind. And the smile he gave me, it's just one of my best and favorite moments of actually meeting a poet who gives me a constant joy in my life.
Yeah, you got to meet the poet, and now you're getting the opportunity to familiarize yourself with the place that shaped that poet. And so much of what you're describing is taking the time to be contemplative, right? Whether it's about a teacup or a tree or part of the land that you're enjoying now. And I feel like the residency experience might be a little bit foreign to people who don't make art and haven't had that experience, but there's something inherent about this residency experience that is about the room and space to be contemplative, just that simple, let's say, task for the artist.
I think we're all, whether we write poetry or not, we are all taxed these days with very little time to get things done. We barely have time to take a breath before we begin our day, or take a breath before we go to bed at night, hoping we'll actually get a good night's rest, knowing we have 50 million things to do. And so this particular residency, I was always attracted to it because it meant going inward and having stillness, being here allows me to see how often in my day I am overstimulated. I am so externally attached to whatever's going on around me that the moment to be still with your thoughts, your voice, your memories, where you are in your life, questions you get to ask yourself that you wouldn't necessarily get to think about, memories of friends, of parents, of beloveds, come to you in a very quiet, beautiful, nurturing way. I know that I've been Wi-Fi withdrawal because in the actual house, there's no Wi-Fi, there's no internet, there's nothing. And so it's been remarkable to withdraw from my doom scrolling and to have to sit quiet and listen to the rain, listen to the roosters, listen to just the wind going through the trees and begin to hear songs in that. So the thing about residencies, this feels very private about kind of solitude or quiet to recharge and have a restorative space for your art, whatever you might make. And what I like about this too, there's no pressure on you to make a product. There's no pressure on you to do your next task or get your to-do list done. You can take things at a pace that feels actually human and healthy for you.
Yeah, because art doesn't always work at that sort of capitalistic pace, that 9-to-5, Monday to Friday pace. Sometimes it needs to take a week off. Sometimes it needs to go hard for a week. And it seems like that's what you get here, that space to decide the pace and the focus that you'll have.
I think that's really true. And the kind of stamina psychically that you need to be making poetry or art. I'm also a photographer. I brought my camera and my tripod and things like that. But it takes time to even know what you're doing, and also to accept when you don't know what you're doing, but you just have to trust your intuition that you're heading in a direction along your journey that is going to show you what to do next, what question to ask, which book to read, which tree to fall in love with. And so I'm grateful that I'm just not running around trying to write the next book or make the next poem, that there is space and time here to almost rest so that you can hear in the stillness the thing that you really need to listen to.
You mentioned photography because you do work in various mediums and you do approach art from various angles, a lot of visual elements as well as the written word. Tell us a little bit about that, because I'm curious to know if it's sometimes that you just have this hunger to work in a certain medium, you really want to work with text, you really want to work with visuals, or if it's a theme or a subject that has grabbed you and dictated to you that this demands language, this demands visuals. How does that process work for you?
The process of crossing genre is always fluent in me. It's always changing. It feels like water. Is it going to be ice? Is it going to be rain? Is it going to be snow? Is it going to be the ocean? And so I have to do a lot of trial and error sometimes to see what it is that the material is demanding. So it's the subject that will demand that I experiment. And so I think of crossing genre as a kind of laboratory or imaginarium, a place to experiment. Sometimes you have to fail really hard and see that it's really not this thing or not that thing to get you on the right track. But I also just like the idea of stretching an idea, an experience, a memory, a theme, stretching it so far that it can cross these different bridges, because it feels sometimes, if I were painting and I had four canvas up on the wall and I make one mark that connects to the other mark on the other wall. And so by going into different genre, it can help me see clearly in each space where I need to go or where I need to be more restrained or what the material wants it to be. So the visual energy has its own heartbeat. It has its own energy than say a poem or say a memoir, which is my next genre that's coming out, or a novel. I just like to think of them as different organs in my body that all have a function and are all very specific and yet all have synergy with each other. And I really like the fact that I can move through these genres and find deeper levels of discovery and deeper depth to whatever I might be working on. And I think for your question, sometimes automatically, I know this is a poem, this is not a painting. This is a novel, this is not a photograph, or this is not a collection of poetry. Sometimes the material is so insistent and so self-aware that I already know this is where I need to be at. This is where I'm going to locate the right format, the right medium. So it really switches all the time depending on what's at stake.
And I would imagine too, there are moments when it feels like a way to recharge or to find a new angle, a fresh angle. Sometimes I imagine you could feel stuck with text or feel stuck with visuals. And it almost feels like a release valve to be able to go and be able to engage another form of idea exploration and storytelling.
Absolutely. Sometimes I will be working on a poem and I get stuck. I've put myself into a corner. And so I might go out and work on photographs for a few days. And when I come back, I say, oh, this is how you get out of this poem. This is the discovery. You couldn't get it yet because you were pressing the button too hard and you needed to step back. And so it's unconsciously in your unconscious, something in you is actually still attached to where you are in that poem, even while you're doing something else. And I think people suggest this sometimes when you're stuck with a story or a song or whatever it might be, a dance or something, your choreography, your directing, go do something else and come back to the work because the work's still going to be there, but something in you might be expanded just a little bit more to help you make that turn or make that leap in the work. And I really believe in that and do it quite frequently. I think the only genre where it's tricky to do that is a novel because you do have to have a certain infrastructure and scaffolding, depending on the kind of novel you're writing, where you can't leave it for too long before it grows moss and, you know, the roof is falling apart and it's a mess. But I like to redirect myself, reframe things, and go back to the work and say, oh, now I know what happens next. There's something really lovely in that.
That was a New York writer and visual artist, Rachel Eliza Griffiths, talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about her time in residence at the Merwin Conservancy. She'll be sharing her work at the Honolulu Museum of Art tonight at 6:30, and then again on Maui on November 25th. For more details, check out our website later today. Well, that's it for this Thursday. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show lined up, highlighting stories from our time out and about in the community. We do welcome feedback. Call or talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.